This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good evening. This is Inside Story with Lee Chui Lin and Sharmila Ganesan. Tonight, a deep dive into what we know so far of Omicron, the new variant of COVID-19.
First, we get into the science of it all. Next, how will new variants impact our economy and our public health fight against the pandemic? Finally, we look at criticisms that the West is being racist in spinning a narrative about Omicron.
Tell us, are you worried when we hear about new variants? You can call us 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio. This is Inside Story. It is 6:08. And so, class, let's welcome the new kid. That really just everyone was dreading. And here he comes, or here they come rather, because on the 24th of November, South African health authorities reported a new variant to the WHO. And that's what we're talking about today, because that new variant is, of course, Omicron.
Yes, so the Omicron variant was spotted in a few samples, and I think what's marked it as this variant of concern is its unusually high number of mutations, which might mean that it's more transmissible and able to evade vaccines. Just to say, they are still studying it, but it is thought to be the reason behind the recent spike in cases in South Africa, but it's not actually known whether it originated there or whether it was brought into the country from elsewhere in the world, in the region. And as I said, WHO is studying the potential impact of the variant. This is the fifth variant of concern that the WHO has flagged. And if you're curious, it's actually named after the 15th letter of the Greek alphabet. The WHO designated the Greek alphabet as the way to name each new mutation of the coronavirus. And if you're wondering why we seem to have skipped two, we skipped new because it sounds too much like new, and Z because, well, it's a common surname, although some have been speculating that this might have to do with President Xi Jinping.
Yeah, so we mentioned South Africa because that's the country that's really been grabbing the headlines. More on that in a second. But it's been detected actually in at least 14 countries from as far afield as, the Netherlands and the UK, but also closer to home like Hong Kong and I believe the Philippines. So it is around now. And as you mentioned earlier, the issue or the thing that has caught a lot of attention is the 30 mutations to its spike protein. Delta has 9, for example. But again, scientists still don't know yet exactly what that's going to do or how it's going to change the behavior of the variant. Preliminary data suggests that it has a higher rate of reinfection, and the origins have not yet been determined. But, and this is important, scientists know that mutations and therefore the possibility of new variants emerging occur in places where vaccination rates are low and transmission is high. That just makes logical sense. And as with other variants, it can be detected via a PCR and RTK test. So there are a number of things that we wanted to explore, right? What we just covered is the science, what little we know of it so far. But then there's also been the reactions to it. And these reactions actually mirror in many ways what we've seen anytime a new variant emerges, because we see countries getting very worried, we see markets reacting, we see bans being imposed.
And I think therein lies some of the criticism. I think some of the concerns, which are natural at this point in the pandemic, but also some of the criticism around how we talk about and how we treat I think the countries involved or cases when it comes to the coronavirus or to COVID-19. So the news, of course, has triggered travel bans. At least 44 countries have imposed temporary restrictions on travel from the Southern Africa region. These include the UK, the US, New Zealand, Canada, and Malaysia as well as of now. Japan and Israel are placing a temporary ban on all foreign travelers. China, meanwhile, hasn't imposed any additional restrictions. In Malaysia, a temporary ban on foreigners from several Southern African countries that don't have APR status or visa here. Malaysians also cannot travel to a number of African countries, and those who come back from those countries are required to go under a 2-week mandatory quarantine period. Now we come to the criticism, which is this question of, Why those countries and why only those parts of the world when we are detecting cases in other countries as well? And I think this whole tying of South Africa with this variant has caused both South Africa as well as other parts of the world, particularly the global south, to talk about this constant narrative from the West of certain parts of the world being more responsible for the travel of the virus than others.
Yeah, I mean, the Delta variant didn't start off being called the Delta variant, right? But we didn't see that same kind of concern being placed on the variants that emerged from the United Kingdom, for instance. No one has ever called that, I don't know, the Suffolk variant or whatever. And so because of that, I think there has been a continued and understandable and deserved sensitivity to how variants are reported. Because, of course, it places the idea of certain countries being more of a hotbed for infection than others, or certain countries being more quote-unquote responsible for mutations or for variants emerging, when, of course, as we said earlier, a lot of that has to do with who can get vaccines. And who can get vaccines has been determined by how many people have bought up vaccines such that they can give booster shots to their residents at a high rate when other people have yet to receive their first dose. And so there is this ongoing issue of how, for example, you see headlines saying new variant in South Africa, as opposed to a new variant sequenced in South Africa, which is much more accurate to say that it was actually scientifically discovered and documented in the country, as opposed to it was there all along, you know. I just think the way in which we talk and think about these things really do matter. And it is enforced in a very big way by the travel bans, which South Africa has denounced as unfair and potentially harmful to their economy. They even go so far as saying that they're being punished for their scientific ability to identify coronavirus variants early. So that's where we stand. And that's pretty much the lay of the land for our show today. We would like to know, are you worried when we hear about new variants? Today, we are talking about Omicron, but there have been other variants designated as of concern. There may be more to come. You can call us 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. After this, we'll be speaking with Dr. Vinod Balasubramaniam, molecular virologist at Monash University, Malaysia. Keep it here on Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Bringing fresh meaning, BFM 89.9.
It is 6:16 and you're listening to Inside Story with Lynn and Sharmila. Today, we are trying to take a look at the Omicron variant, the new variant of COVID-19 that has been designated as a variant of concern by the WHO. And we want to hear from you. Are you worried when you hear about new variants? There have been a number. You can call us 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. And now to get into the science of it all, we're crossing over to Dr. Vinod Balasubramaniam, molecular virologist at Monash University, Malaysia. Dr. Vinod, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
All right. So what do we know about Omicron?
So this guy is new kid on the block, right? It descends from the B11 lineage, right? Similar to the Alpha variant we had previously, right? Very unprecedented and very unusual, right? In the number of mutations, right? It has 32 and more mutations in the spike protein, most important protein for cell entry, right? And some of the mutations are associated with helping the virus to escape detection from antibodies and increase the ability to gain entry to our cells, right? Making it more transmissible, right? One important thing to note is that these mutations are concentrated in an area that interacts with human cells, right? So this does not automatically mean that these variations are more dangerous, simply that the virus has further adapted to human species by generating another variant. We need further studies to tell us if this adaptation is neutral or less dangerous or more dangerous.
So a lot of people are drawing comparisons with the Delta strain, right? How does it compare?
The astonishing number of mutations in the important domain, which we call the receptor binding domain, where the antibodies from vaccines recognize and bind to neutralize the virus, right? So it has astonishing total mutations of more than 50 total mutations on the virus itself, right? And Delta has somewhere lesser than 20 in the spike protein. So yeah, we're still finding out whether these mutations are detrimental or, you know, increases the fitness of the virus or even pathogenesis of the virus.
So I think a question that many people are worried about, are our existing vaccines effective in fighting the Omicron variant?
Thank you so much for this question. This is lingering in everybody's mind. You know, I'm getting WhatsApp messages, you know, people are asking, you know, okay, so the vaccines won't work. No, this is simply not the case, right? While the mutations are worrying, right? While mutations are worrying, whether the vaccine, available vaccines work or not is still unanswered, right? It's too soon to know. Now look at it, let's look at the positives. Now, what can be considered as good news is that mRNA vaccines such as Pfizer and Moderna are likely adaptable against most variants in a, you know, faster time, right? And most of the mutations in Omicron are in the same parts of the spike protein as those in the other variants which have emerged, right? At least from a speculative point of view, we have some optimism that the vaccine still works against new variants for serious diseases. In reality, we have to wait, right? Immunity from vaccination, especially from booster doses, is still likely to protect us from severe diseases. You know, we might get all these symptoms, you know, all these niggling symptoms like fever, body aches, sore throat, you know, fatigue, loss of smell, although vaccinated, but chances of developing severe symptoms, hospitalization, mortality will be greatly diminished, especially with the booster doses coming, you know, being deployed currently in Malaysia, at least.
So we're seeing this Omicron variant in a number of countries, including Britain, Israel, Hong Kong and the Philippines. Is it really only a matter of time before it makes its way to our shores?
Definitely, definitely. I'll give you one example, right? Within 3 weeks of discovery of the Delta strain, right? It was discovered in 53 countries. 53 countries. That's how rapid, you know, respiratory viruses can spread. And, you know, even with the strict, you know, travel bans and restriction, it still managed to go simply because, you know, it's so hard because, it, you know, it can travel in all sort of other ways, for example, from supply chains, for example, right? Yeah.
Now, how equipped is our healthcare system to face new variants and the potential complications that could arise from them?
So we have learned a lot from the past 1.5 years, you know, in terms of management, in terms of use of anti-inflammatory drugs, so on and so forth. Right, including patient management, right? Use of ICU, use of respirators, you know. However, this does not mean that, you know, the healthcare system can be overburdened again, especially with severe symptoms, you know, mortality, severe hospitalizations, right? While we have learned, we must understand that we must, you know, adhere to all the SOPs, you know, prevent ourselves from getting infected. Because with the current variants, you will get infected although you are vaccinated, right? Yeah, so it's important to note that.
Do you think then there might be a need to return to full lockdown measures?
That's a good question. You know, everybody's freaking out that, you know, warning signs are there. So it depends on many aspects. You have to look at the R value. You have to look at the ICU usage. You have to look at the bed usage and also mortality rates, right? All that. If there is an increase, I'm worried. At the end of the day, you know, the government, you know, is left with no choice but to impose, you know, impose some sort of restriction at least.
So many countries have imposed a travel ban to and from South Africa. Some countries like Japan are actually barring entry for all foreign visitors. Are travel bans an effective measure?
While it's understandable why they are doing that, right? They are buying time to get their system in order, they are buying time to increase their genomic surveillance, they are buying time to actually, you know, look at their healthcare system, you know, before eventually it comes, the virus crosses the border. This is not a long-term feasible solution, right? First, we must understand why are we getting more and more variants, right? So I'll give you one example. If there is an vaccination actually creates barriers in our body, from the virus to freely replicate and to be transmitted, right? The more unvaccinated people exist, the higher chance of a virus mutate, the higher chance of you getting an emerging variant, right? Look at South Africa. The total vaccination rate of adult population somewhere around 30 to 35%, right? While we are talking about booster doses here, we have people still waiting for their first dose in South Africa. Hence, why we are getting more and more variants from that region. So in the long run, I don't think so it's feasible, you know, just to block out, you know, because this is a global problem, right? This is a global pandemic. It requires global solution. Yeah.
We have a question from a listener. Delma wants to know, do we have the capacity to track Omicron?
Definitely, definitely. Because the conventional PCR tests and the real-time PCR tests, you know, designated by WHO still detects the virus. Still detects the virus. So, yeah, I get a lot of questions regarding that too. But these, you know, primers which detects actually targets conserved regions of the coronavirus, not the regions which are changing. So, yeah, we still can detect.
And what is the dominant variant in Malaysia at the moment? I mean, what does it mean when a dominant variant in a country shifts?
So, when you talk about dominant variant, right, there are two things you have to consider. One, fitness, right? Number two, pathogenicity. Okay, you have to fulfill both of this. And Delta currently fulfills both of this, which is why we have a lot of other variants which came in, you know, and subsided. Now, you can move variant, right? The move variant came in. You have the South African variant which came in and subsided. So a virus needs to have both of this, you know, to become a dominant variant, right? So currently, I don't see any other variants, you know, replacing Delta, right? And we are getting news from South Africa and other parts of the world that the symptoms from Omicron are much, much, you know, not as worse as Delta, right? So, yeah, that's good news for starters. We still need to wait, but yeah.
So now that our borders are slowly reopening and we're seeing these emergence of new variants, what sorts of measures should we have in place to limit the spread of the virus as well as the variants?
So, you know, as this is like a mantra. So we have the weapons. I like to call it weapons, right? Simple, you know, get your vaccination, get your booster doses if you're eligible, wear mask, ensure social distancing, ensure your rooms are better, you know, well ventilated, practice hand hygiene, right? Prevent yourself from getting infected and passing on to others. So this is the core. So I think we need to, you know, enforce and strengthen the SOPs, you know, similar to when we had the first wave or second wave.
I'm just trying to understand something about how viruses, I guess, keep going, right? And so when we have a virus that mutates to become, for example, or a variant that that becomes more infectious, does that automatically set us up for even more scary, more infectious, more frightening variants in the future?
So viruses mutate, especially RNA viruses mutate a lot, right? Coronaviruses are part of the bigger group of RNA viruses. They mutate a lot simply because of the error-prone polymerase gene that they have in them, right? And most of the time, right, viruses mutate to stay relevant, right? Each time there are barriers in a susceptible host, they mutate. It's some sort of like, you know, changing your dress so that you're not recognizable, right? So each time it changes its dress to stay relevant so that it can still infect new hosts, right? While mutations sometimes can be beneficial, most of the times too much of mutation is detrimental to the virus. So most of that, you know, people misunderstand that, okay, just because it's mutation, that's it, we are dead. You know, there's this doomsday scary variant is there. And, you know, so it does not work that way, right? It's not as straightforward as you know, as we think it is.
So scientists are still gathering information on Omicron. What type of data will be helpful in informing us how to manage the spread?
Well, that's a good question. First of all, transmissibility data, right? The R value of the virus. We are getting news that the R value of Omicron is close to 2. That's very high. That means it's easier to be transmitted. And another thing, very important thing that we need to know is the ability of antibodies from vaccine, capabilities of antibodies neutralizing this virus. Because the virus induces change at the target site of the antibody. Like I said before, antibodies are very specific. If you're wearing a green shirt, it recognizes the green shirt. If you're wearing other color shirt, you know, it takes time or it won't recognize. That's the problem. Yeah. So we need to know whether the antibodies from current vaccines is able to neutralize. If yes, to what extent? So that is what all the vaccine manufacturers are doing now. I think in less than 2 weeks, we'll have the data.
Dr. Vinod, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Dr. Vinod Balasubramaniam, molecular virologist at Monash University, Malaysia, giving us what we know so far of the Omicron variant. We've been asking you, are you worried when we hear about new variants? You can send us your thoughts and questions. Call 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio.
Beyond Frivolous Matters, BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
It is 6:38 and you're listening to Inside Story with Lynn and Sharmila. And today we're talking about Omicron, the newest strain of the coronavirus that has been designated as a variant of concern by the WHO. So earlier we found out all that we could, I think, about the science of it, what we know so far. And now we want to look ahead to perhaps how it impacts us as a whole, right? When it comes to economy, policymaking and the like. In the meantime, keep those thoughts coming. We're asking you, are you worried when you hear about new variants? You can call us 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at PFM Radio. Joining us now, though, is Tricia Yeo, CEO of IDEAS, Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs. Tricia, as always, pleasure to have you on.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
So how have the emergence of earlier variants prior to this impacted economies both here in Malaysia and globally?
Well, I think it's common knowledge that the variants in the past 2 years have greatly impacted the economies. I think there's no way to talk about economic growth and development in the year or years coming forward without considering the impact, the tremendous impact that COVID-19 has wreaked upon the world. But I think as we talk about this new variant coming forward, it's important to note that it's not really the virus itself that has impacted the economy as much as it has been about the responses and the reactions that governments have taken with regards to how they manage the public health crisis. So that, and I think moving forward, I know some of this we need to talk about, is thinking about how public policies can be better managed and taking steps from the past to lead us into the future. I mean, we've had 2 years and we obviously need to learn lessons for ourselves in doing better.
So before we get to, before we unpack some of that really, how are we seeing markets and businesses respond now to Omicron?
I think the market response is quite mixed. So I know that there are some parts of the world where the markets have plummeted. Some, I think in Europe, it's been fairly stable. But I again, there were some panics and alarm bells that were raised. But again, the panic, I believe, and I think the Wall Street Journal actually had a good article on this, which said that the panic, and I quote, may be driven more by the fear of new government lockdowns and social distancing than by the variant itself, unquote. So we know, for example, that, yeah, the Dow fell and the US crude prices fell as well. But I think, yeah, like I said, in Europe, it was fairly stable. So it really depends on, I think the reactions are probably a reaction to how the governments in that particular region reacted to the variants of concern in the past. So kind of taking the past as knowledge for the future.
Which brings us very neatly to our next question, because so far, Health Minister Kari Jamaluddin has really shied away from saying that there will be a return to full lockdown measures. He has said that we may have to take certain measures, but it's not going to be a full lockdown. Do you think that there is, however, a possibility that we will need it? And what will be the impact of doing so?
So it depends on who you speak to, really. I think while we were in the thick of the practically 5 to 6 month full lockdown this year, IDEAS came up with many, many media statements. And in my own interviews, I talked about how ultimately we all know it's about finding that neat spot, the perfect spot between balancing of public health interests and economic interests. But ultimately, what we also said was that we don't believe that the country should actually do any blanket lockdown measures in the future or any kind of blanket measures in the future. So it's not just about the economy. It's also about like the secondary things like schools and what what are the implications on our children? I don't think we've even really unpacked that enough. What has the result of this very, very strict and harsh blanket lockdown been on children and teachers, educators alike? So ideally, what we want to do moving forward, which is what we were prescribing in the past, and I think many, many have tried to talk about this, you know, mathematicians and statisticians, like people who believe in data, even what I've heard in some of these discussions with regards to National Recovery Council and so on, we keep saying that we want to be data-driven, but I don't think we've fully seen the right way of being data-driven. So we've got like some kind of websites and so on coming out. We've now got so much data, for example, from MySejahtera. There were plans by the ministry to do this special measure where, you know, if you remember at one point, all the malls were shut down like in just overnight, or was it 1 to 2 days, they shut down all these malls. So we have the data, but are we using that correctly? My point is that with sufficient data, which we do have a lot of, but we need to do better at making sense of it, this data analysis will point us into the direction of what sectors and where things need to be shut down. So being very targeted in our approach to avoid any kind of further drastic unemployment rate spiking. And we just cannot see a repeat of what happened this year, where if you're thinking about retail sector, the bare minimum of the retail sector that has survived the storm over the last 2 years, what you do see that still exists, the restaurants that you can still frequent now, I believe still that they're struggling and they're also hanging on to perhaps the last of their reserves. So we really need to be careful and think this through. Again, just if I have not said this already, we cannot afford blanket measures because we need to be driven by data and ideally have it targeted as much as possible.
And if there was a requirement for international borders to be tightened again, what impact might that have?
Well, travel, for sure. I think in the very beginning, the very first sector to be hit as early as, what was it, like February, March 2020, all the way back. If you recall, the first stimulus package that was announced by the then PH government, or rather there wasn't really a PH government, it was just Mahathir at that time, as the acting prime minister, I believe it was called. So he was actually the first to release the stimulus package. I think not many people remember that, but the first stimulus package actually targeted the tourism sector. So for all this time, the tourism sector has been the worst hit, and that would suffer major consequences again. I think they've just started to breathe a sigh of relief. And if the borders start to close again, that would be number one. Number two, I would say business travel a little bit, but I also think that the business sector has been able to adapt fairly significantly. You know, previously they would have to fly very frequently, but they realized that, okay, you can do lots of conference calls without having to incur a huge carbon footprint. So the main thing would be travel, really, and of course, families who are separated from borders.
So we have a couple of minutes left with you, Tricia, and we've been through this cycle several times now. You pointed it out also of borders and SOPs loosening, tightening, businesses shuttering, trying to reopen. At this stage in the pandemic, knowing what we know, what long-term policy measures do we need to manage our way through new variants?
So we need to have firstly like a good grasp of, I mean, I may be sounding repetitious here, but I think having a good grasp of data, what the data is telling us, being transparent about the data as well. So making that data available as much as possible throughout the different levels of state and federal governments. So whatever state governments are collecting, they should be sharing it with the federal. Whatever federal is collecting, they should be sharing with state governments. Because you're then much more able to make quicker decisions and knowing where to target the policy. So I think some of this decision-making can be decentralized. I know it's not really something that will happen. I mean, if you ask me this a year from now, I probably will say the same thing about data and policy decentralization. I think the other thing we need to do is really strengthen our public health system. I don't think that the issue, although it's died down now, I don't think the issue of contract doctors was ever resolved. And we know that if we are planning to treat COVID-19 as an endemic rather than a pandemic, which is what many people have been saying, including the health minister, then what we're saying is that it will be among us for a number of years, where you have new variants of concern, you know, I was just joking to my colleagues today that they may run out of Greek alphabets, right, to name the new variants of concern. But the point is that if we're going to see this as a permanent fixture in society, making sure that number one, data, number two, public health systems, we cannot afford to have our public health systems collapse or almost collapse the way we saw. And this is just hardly a few months ago, but I think memories are short in Malaysia. If you remember, there were devastating photos and videos of Klang Valley hospitals, which, by the way, should be closest to Putrajaya to be able to depend on, you know, easy access to emergency procurement. So I think those are some of the rules and regulations that really need to be looked at. Like, why was it just so difficult to get in an efficacious manner? And I mean, the third would be looking again at our economic system. Like, can we afford to depend, for example, on the GLCs? And the GLCs, the GLC ecosystem, was greatly dependent upon to contribute huge amounts of money and you know, aid and contributions. I think that's good that they're there for social economic reasons, but can the country also afford that? Because at the end of the day, you know, if they're in the red, who bails them out and who makes the decision to decide which GLCs can be saved and which won't be saved? And I suppose a very broad number four would be thinking about our entire fiscal structure and system, because if even if pockets of lockdowns take place, economic aid will be demanded upon, right, from government. So can governments afford to continue these kinds of endless stimulus packages year in and year out? And not just that, I mean, thinking also about the existing debt and deficit that the country's budget have had to sustain over the last 2 years. And, you know, don't forget, we made some of these extraordinary measures in light of COVID-19. What I mean by extraordinary measures would be the increasing of the debt to GDP statutory limit. And it was 55%, it climbed to 60, it's 65% now. So what I think we're going to see is that a completely fundamental change in the way we view public economics as a result of managing the COVID-19 pandemic. And again, will this be a permanent fixture? And if it is, thinking long term, right? Like 10 years, 20 years down the line, how is our fiscal financial system structured? And I do think the Ministry of Finance, the Treasury, is thinking through these steps. And in fact, we've been, you know, in many of these discussions, thinking about tax, thinking of alternatives. But whatever it is, we need to exercise great financial and fiscal discipline in the years to come.
Tricia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Tricia Yeo, CEO of IDEAS, talking about the impact of the new Omicron variant on our economy and our policy. Now, after this, we're going to be talking about South Africa and where they enter the picture and how that narrative has been spun. So keep it here on Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Brainy, fancy material. BFM 89.9.
It is 6:52. You're listening to Inside Story with Lynn and Sharmila. We've been talking today about the Omicron variant. And now we wanted to close off with the way that the variant itself has been reported and the country that it's been linked to. And for that, we're joined by Dr. Tharani Loganathan, Public Health Specialist at University of Malaya. Dr. Tharani, welcome to the show.
Good evening, Julian.
Hi.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Let's start with this, right? In the reporting on the new variant, we've seen headlines like the new variant is in South Africa, even the South African variant. What do you make of the associations being made in the global press between the variant and South Africa?
Right. Actually, the variant was detected in South Africa, but I think it's wrong to call it the South African variant. The WHO actually does not name their variants based on location of first detection. It is they usually give them a very very hard to remember name, which is numbers. But for ease of public consumption, they're named by Greek alphabets. So this variant is called the Omicron variant. Okay, it's easier, of course, for press and general public to talk about the country of origin. Okay, but it's not actually the best way of describing a variant.
What are your thoughts on countries acting to impose travel bans or restrictions on specifically South Africa and other African countries, but not on other countries that already have cases of Omicron?
Yes, it might be seen as an overreaction. Okay, usually, travel bans is not actually the best way of protecting a country from viral infection or importation of viral infection. We actually have a very, very small window if that is to happen, because on detection, I mean, the virus was detected in South Africa, but it could have gone actually, it could have been imported from somewhere else. And there's been a lot of travel before that time period. And now we see that the virus is actually in many countries around the world, in Europe, in Israel, in many countries, and there are even cases reported of local transmission. Okay, so if we ban countries in the African region alone, what does that mean? You know, is it right, or is it driven by political reasons, or is it driven by science? So we have to think about that. Yeah.
And what are the social and economic implications of attributing a variant to a country or a region?
Okay, so once, I mean, that in many, we can look at it from the individual point, okay? So like, for instance, when the SARS-CoV-2 was first identified and people were calling it the Wuhan or the China virus, you know the narrative that was taking a place in the United States is China variant. So on the individual basis, I mean, if you're an Asian person, you get discriminated, you get called names. In fact, some people were throwing things at people and, you know, violence. So you get discriminated. But also from a larger perspective, if you look from in terms of countries and populations, you would have trade restrictions, travel restrictions. So it would affect the economy of a country and so on. So it's not good to be discriminatory in that sense. Yeah.
So to draw on that narrative, right, broadly speaking, there have been criticisms of the global north of pushing this sort of racist narrative and this idea of Western superiority every time a new variant emerges. How would you respond to that?
You know, I mean, science, like, basically it doesn't see skin color or which part of the world you're coming from and so on. This virus is totally blind to all that. Okay, so I would say instead of being racist, I think we should be looking at it in the terms of global solidarity. Okay, if for instance, we've been having vaccines for some months now, and Africa, only what, 10% of the continent, entire continent, has had one dose, and America, not and Europe and so on, they have like 60%. Our country, we claim to have like 95%. So what does that mean? You know, so are we, is it actually Africa's fault for, you know, for having variants? Or is it our fault for not working together to make sure everyone is vaccinated? Yeah.
We have just a minute left with you, but how would vaccine equity help to stem the emergence of variants?
So, I mean, the thing is, currently vaccines are the only known protection against a viral transmission. Okay, so if in countries or in places where the population is not vaccinated, that means you have a risk of transmission being uncontrolled. And the more it transmits, the more chances of mutation. I mean, I'm saying this in a very simplistic way, but yeah, that's it. So I hope that's simple enough, but you know what I'm trying to say here. So we are trying to break the chain of transmission. The vaccine is the way to do it. But it's also not just the vaccine, but it's the most effective way. We also have social distancing, hand washing, masking, and all that. basically, we need to vaccinate the world. It's not just enough to look after our own country and our own populations.
Dr. Tarini, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you so much for having me.
That was Dr. Tarini Loganathan, public health specialist at University of Malaya, talking to us about the links that have been drawn between South Africa and the Omicron variant and why they can be problematic in the larger fight against COVID-19. Now, as we've been saying, send us your thoughts. You can call us 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. You've been listening to Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.